Hi everyone, the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the following podcast belong solely to the host and its contributors. They are not necessarily the views of our employers, organizations, committees, or other group or individual.
I'm David Campbell.
And I'm Joseph Whitney. This is Brewing with BIM,
where we talk about construction processes, technology, BIM, and beer.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Brewing with BIM. With me as always is Dave Campbell and Jordan Bolek. What's going on, fellas?
Hey, Joe.
Hey, Joey. Hey, David. Great to be back.
Yeah, it is indeed. We've got a very special guest with us here today, Gary Cohen. Comes to us on St. Patrick's Day from Ireland. What's going on, Gary?
Hello, guys. How are you?
Doing very well, sir. You've got quite the history with BIM and applications, and it's just very fortunate for us to get you on this episode. So thank you for making time.
Oh, no, thank you very much for the invitation. I'm a longtime listener of the podcast, so I'm really excited to get to meet you guys in person and have a beer and have a chat all about BIM. I love BIM. I bore most people talking about BIM because, as you guys know, not a lot of people outside of BIM understand it. So it's nice to talk to like-minded guys who understand what you're talking about and not just look at you like you're talking Chinese or something, you know?
Oh, yeah. My wife rolls her eyes constantly whenever I talk anything to do with BIM or construction technology. But that said, you mentioned a key word there. You said drinking with us. What are you drinking, Gary?
Well, I'm actually sitting having a tin of Harp Irish Lager at the moment, which is brewed here. It's a very popular beer here in Northern Ireland. Most places you go has it sort of on tap. Obviously Guinness would be the biggest beer here in Ireland. It's actually brewed by Diego, the makers of Guinness. So I'm not really into the Guinness myself. Shock horror, there's an Irishman who doesn't like Guinness, but I prefer a lager over a stout or a sort of a darker beer. I don't really go for the stouts at all.
When I was over there, we drank Beamish more than anything. I think it was Beamish is the beer, more than anything. And you have a lot of cask ales all throughout England, Ireland, Scotland, which I've seen more cask ales over there than anywhere in the United States. And tremendous beer scene over there.
Yeah, there's so many different types of beers. Certainly here in Ireland, there's Smithwick's and there's lots of different types of pilsners and, you know, obviously being close to Europe, you get a lot of the European beers here as well. You get the Carlsbergs and there's Carling. There's quite a lot of different, very, very large selections of beer here. So kind of spoiled for choice, almost too many.
What about you, David? Are you drinking anything today?
Ah, dude, actually, I'm sipping on an old fashioned. I ended up grabbing some Whistle Pig. I had a long day. I was looking in the beer fridge and realized I only had Trulies, so I didn't really want to do that on today's podcast. So I reached for the Whistle Pig and made a nice old fashioned.
I owe you a bottle of Whistle Pig, by the way. Yeah. Jordan, are you sipping on anything, my friend?
I have a very beautiful beer mug, absolutely filled to the brim with a nice clear glass of water. No, I didn't have anything in the beer fridge tonight. I just got done with dinner, so I had a protein shake. So I was like, maybe hold off a couple hours before I start sipping on the beer. So,
yeah, I'm in a similar boat. I just realized that I'm out of whiskey. I don't know why I didn't realize this before. I had back-to-back meetings and I didn't have a chance to get out. So I am literally just drinking some like ginger ale, you know, zero sugar, probably bad for my health, ginger ale.
Hey, so when you have the hiccups halfway through the call. We know why.
Well, let's not bore anybody with our poor alcohol or lack of alcohol choices, Jordan. Gary, we had a call before this. You have a tremendous background in BIM. You spanned 20 years in BIM. Can you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourselves?
Yeah, certainly. My name is Gary Cohen, and I'm the head of digital construction for a large multidisciplined built and services engineering design and build contractor based here in Northern Ireland called Kane, K-A-N-E, Kane Group. We work exclusively in sort of the London market at the moment, and we do quite a lot of projects in the commercial space and residential, schools, hotels, and healthcare. Quite most of the industry, probably. I've been with Canes for around about 10 years now. I started with Canes way back in 2013 as their first ever BIM technician. And at that stage, the company had really secured a contract with a very large European contractor to do a large secondary school or high school in London. And BIM was a requirement, and they'd never done BIM before. So they sort of put a job advert out at the time. And I'd had a few years experience with BIM at that stage. I'd worked for a couple of different companies here in Northern Ireland. And at that stage, BIM really was in its infancy. You know, it was unheard of in the industry. And I had worked with another company here in Ireland called Mercury, who are very, very advanced in the sort of BIM field. And I worked on a project with them in around 2009, I believe it was, building a hospital here in Northern Ireland in a place called Enniskillen, the Southwest Acute Hospital. And that's kind of where I really got my eyes open to BIM. I had been involved in the construction industry, obviously, for a number of years before that. Kind of I studied at Queen's University, Belfast here, and did mechanical engineering. Nothing really to do with building services, but kind of fell into building services through the sandwich year that you do as part of your degree. So you do 2 years in university, and then you go into industry for a year. And it was by pure chance that I got into the building services, as a couple of friends of mine had went to university kind of a year ahead of me. And I got a phone call one day to say, "Hi, Gary, I'm finishing my sandwich placement here, and they're looking for someone to take my place. Would you be available next year?" And of course, I hadn't got round to organising any sort of sandwich year that year. So kind of just fell into place that I went in and worked in a place for the civil service, as it's called here in the UK, which is a governmental body who looks after all of the government buildings and stuff. So that kind of opened my eyes to the building services side of engineering and kind of gave me a taste for building services design. And then I went back and finished my degree then in Queen's and graduated in 2006, I believe it was. And straight away entered into a company in Belfast as Red Sky as a CAD technician. Really, that was my strength at that time. And obviously, way back in 2006, everything was just two-dimensional CAD. You know, it was all just 2D polylines. And very much, if you wanted to design a building, it was just a best guess, would you say? You know, it was from start to finish and pipe sizes and annotations. So kind of learned my trade in those years in 2D AutoCAD. And, you know, yourselves, if you had to draw a section, you had to really imagine what the section looked like. You know, you had to draw the walls and the floors and the slab and really picture in your mind what it was like in the section, and sort of learned on the ropes, on the tools as such, you know, as a young engineer working alongside sort of senior engineers. And then very early in my career, I had the opportunity then to actually go into project management. A company that I worked for, one of the main contract managers kind of quit on the job, just down tools and walked out. And the big boss who I worked for at the time, Stephen Boyce, said, you know, if you want to crack at it, you can have a go at running the jobs. And at that stage of my career, I kind of had my eyes on consultancy. I really sort of thought at that stage that I would like to have progressed towards being a consultant. I kind of knew in my own self and my own heart that if I didn't really understand building services from a technical point of view of how it went together, how it was supported, you know, the rules that are required to produce a fully functioning and commissionable system, that I was going to have to hit the sites for a few years to get a bit of experience under my belt. So I kind of took that opportunity at the time, and I left the CAD technician role and I jumped into a project manager role. And I sort of worked for about 5 or 6 years as a contracts manager around various sites all over the UK and Ireland, mainly shop fitting and commercial stuff, nothing really too big. But then sort of I managed to land that project manager's role in the Southwest Acute Hospital in Enniskillen. And when I walked on the site, as I say, Mercury, the main M&E guys were using BIM at that stage. And I was just completely blown away by the system. And I was like, what is this? You know, what is this sorcery? Because I had been used to drawing stuff in 2D and trying to figure out sections. So when I seen the system, I was like, I've got to get me that. So I was lucky enough then, I was granted a license through that company because we were kind of working in tandem with them. And at the start, they were actually quite, how would you say, reluctant to work with us because we had been given a portion of their work and they weren't too happy that we had been given it. So they kind of threw me all their drawings. We were tasked with installing the above ground drainage, all of the HDP pipework that was taking all of the foul drainage and the rainwater from the roofs. So on my first day, I walked onto the site and there was quite a lot of engineers running around at that stage. And the job had kind of been progressed for about 6 weeks before I arrived. And when I arrived on site and sort of site walked the first day, I had seen that they'd put quite a lot of the drainage in at that stage. And then I started looking at the drawings and everything was modular at that stage, even back in 2009, which was revolutionary at that stage. But all of the M&E services in the main corridor runs were all being brought in modular frames. And very quickly I realized that we had crossed that module probably 100 times down the corridor with our pipework. And as I was reviewing the site, I could see the lorries pulling into the site with the lateral frames on the back of it. And very quickly, you know, the guys that were bringing the modules in had no care about our pipework. They were up cutting big sections of pipework out. And there was almost fisticuffs on site for the first few days because everyone just didn't understand what was going on. So I kind of had to stop all of our guys and say, right, guys, just down tools and go home. I'm going to have to go and speak to the director of the company that I worked for at the time. So I drove to the office and said to him, like, you know, we've done 6 weeks of work and we're going to have to basically take half of it back out again to be able to allow these modules to be installed. And then we're going to have to try and figure out how our pipework goes back through. Now, I was only about 26 or 27 at the time, so it was actually quite daunting for me at the time. I had to go right up to almost the head of construction for the main contractor and knock his door and say to him, look, we've got a serious, serious problem here. You know, we've got two major companies just completely butting heads here. We need to sit down and figure out what's went wrong. Where's the gap in the scope? You know, how has this happened? And this is probably my first week in the job. And long story short, the director pulled the two companies in and just said to us, guys, you know, yous are committed to the job. Yous have signed a contract. Yous are going to have to make this work. So Mercury were paid a bit of money to allow us a few licenses into the Navis Works and the Revit. And that was really where I discovered Revit and three-dimensional coordination. And as I say, I was completely blown away. Couldn't believe it. So what we had to do was we had to figure out the routes that were left inside their modules for our pipework and figure out how we could create. They had obviously coordinated the drainage through their modules, but then deleted it in bad temper because they lost that portion of their contract. So we had to almost reverse engineer their modules and stuff. So it was a fantastic job. Really was.
Were they using Navisworks at that time before, or like, or were you the one that introduced Navisworks?
No, they were fully proficient. They were using Navisworks for class detection and looking at the models, but it was very much Revit that was being authored. It was the authoring tool, and it was the original Revit. If you've ever seen the original versions of Revit that was around before it really took flight, it was a lot more basic than it is now, certainly. But even at that stage in 2009, it was space age stuff. I couldn't get over it. So that was me. I was sold. I got myself the license through there and just basically took it home and started using it at home. I was using it in work during the day, and then I was sitting at home at night and I was drawing previous projects and I was drawing my own house and my mum and dad's house and anything that I could measure, anything I could get my hands on. I was hand sketching and then drawing just to learn how to use Revit.
I think that's how we all started, right? Is everybody just wanted to model their own house, get that done, notch that out. Or your dream house even. It's very powerful when you can actually apply something that isn't emotionally attached to you or, you know, is deeply interested in you to learn the software. And I feel like that's probably where architectural software, especially something as powerful as Revit in the 3D modeling space, allows us to kind of, I don't know what to say, it didn't help us master, but it helps us at least show interest and see the value in it. Like, it's easy to see the renderings and know the work that you did and why it looks the way it does. But the information in it, that's the key. And you've had a tremendous experience. We were talking about some amazing hotels that you had done with tricky fit outs in the basement and retrofits. Just crazy stuff that you've done in the MEP space. Is most of your experience in the MEP side, or are you kind of just all over?
Yeah, well, I'm a mechanical engineer by trade myself, you know, and most of my experience has been in the MEP space. I started work for Keynes 10 years ago, as I said, and it was very much when I started with Keynes, here's a computer, here's Revit installation files on a USB pen, off you go. So I kind of had free rein almost to craft my own system and craft my own way of work. And I've spent the last decade in Keynes really working on a robust system that I do believe we're kind of, not to blow my own trumpet, but we're kind of market leaders in the space now as what we're producing. Keynes, we pride ourselves on being a pre-fabrication contractor. So the story that you've sort of mentioned there would be in and around the Claridge's Hotel. So obviously over the last 10 years, it has went from a running start to where we are. But there was a lot of development through that time and how we used Revit and the level of detail that we model to. Certainly when we first started using Revit and Keynes, I was the only BIM technician and there was several CAD technicians in the company that worked alongside with me. My colleague Craig Doran was the sort of head of CAD at that stage, and he had spent a number of years developing the CAD standards in the company to a really, really good stage where they had all their system colors sorted out and their, you know, their annotations. And he really had a real good handle on, you know, the design aspect of Keynes, and it was really good what he was producing, but it was still 2D CAD. So I kind of took him under my wing and said, right, you know, I'm going to teach you Revit and you're going to show me how I make this system fit with Keynes. So between him and I, we kind of molded this amazing system that now sort of, if you see our website, you see some of the stuff that we're knocking out. It's unreal. We prefabricate as much as we can now. Obviously, with the modern methods of construction that are now sort of, we would say commonplace for us because we're kind of used to it, but certainly it's quite groundbreaking stuff in the rest of the world in America.
Yeah, we're definitely leading, yep, or definitely following your lead on the BIM standards and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
On the prefab side, this is a very important topic because it's a very hot topic in the United States, very contentious. We find that a lot of pushback with modeling for prefabrication purposes, particularly because of lack of spooling in Revit or what have you. What are some of the challenges that you've had to mitigate between the lack of software functionality to deploy model-based prefabrication workflows?
Yeah, well, when we first started using Revit, as I was sort of explaining I was the only BIM technician and there was a CAD crew that did the CAD. So initially I drew everything in Revit using Revit pipework and Revit ductwork and used Revit purely as a coordination tool, just to use it in 3D to be able to look at the building in 3D, to be able to cut sections very quickly and check corridors and stuff. And we actually didn't use drawn sheets at that stage. So I would have created the view, coordinated everything, annotated it, and then spat that out on a 2D CAD and handed that to the 2D CAD technicians, who then would have did the title block and all of the sort of title block stuff. And then that would have went out as the initial drawn. And then any amendments to that, it would have had been done in 3D and then re-spat out again. So that was probably for the first 2 years we did that. And that was purely because I was the only technician that could use Revit, and the company was much, much smaller than we are now. And obviously it was a big cost to take Revit on at that stage. But over the course of the next few years, we kind of learned the ropes with Revit and how we could actually produce the drawings directly in Revit. So that was the first big step. And then we just got rid of the CAD altogether and we said, right, now we can do our sheets in Revit. Now we can keep a close eye on the revision sequences and stuff like that. But for me, I always sort of seen the next step, and we were prefabricating at that stage, but the prefabrication team worked completely in MEP, AutoCAD MEP. So the prefabrication was a lot smaller at that stage. It would have been individual pump rigs or small items for plant rooms, you know, like a rack of something or a skid that we would have sort of sent over a couple of pipes, pump sets and things like that. It was very, very small. But what we used to do was we would have exported, say, the plant room from the Revit model into a 3D CAD and handed that to the prefab team. And they would have went away and they would have did their work on MEP. And then a couple of weeks later, I would have went back to them and said, right, guys, how are you getting on? And they would have said, oh, we've everything designed and it's on the lorry and it's on its way to London. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, I haven't even seen it. You know, you haven't given me it back. I need to bring it back in. And 90% of the time when the stuff landed on site, the site had moved on. You know, the model had moved on. There was containment now in the room. There was flu put in that we didn't know about. So 9 times out of 10, the boys had to stand and take it apart and alter it on site, which was unplanned work, extra cost, extra materials. And it didn't really work. So we were getting more and more into the prefabrication. So I went into the director of prefabrication, John McMullen, and I said to him, John, we need to bring the prefab guys into Revit. And he was very staunchly against it at the start. He was like, no, the Revit pipework doesn't have the correct fittings. It doesn't have the correct bend radiuses. You know, it's too theoretical to be able to produce shop drawings. And I sort of agreed with him at the time. I was like, yes, but, you know, we'll have to look into it and see how we could get around it. And that was probably, thinking about it, around about 2015, 2016. And it was just at that time that Revit released fabrication services. And I sort of jumped straight onto it and started looking at it and using it. But again, as with everything Autodesk, there was very, very little information out in the ether for me to understand how this thing worked. It's typical Autodesk. They just launch it and leave you to figure it out on your own.
So
we're very familiar with this.
it's ridiculous. So again, just took myself off for a couple of weeks and buried myself in a room down the back and figured out how fabrication services worked, how to create a FabCAD config file, where to source the ITM files, how does fabrication work in Revit, you know, how do the filters work, can we group it, you know, just understand how it works. So I spent about 6 months building a really good fabrication palette in line with the requirements of the prefab guys. You know, we've got a couple of guys at work, but a good friend of mine, Big Carl, he works in prefab. You know, if Carl doesn't know anything about prefab, it's not worth knowing. So I leaned on him very heavily to look at all the ITM files and make sure that, and it was all manufacturer specific stuff that we can get here in the UK. So it kind of ticked a lot of boxes for me in that, yes, this is going to work. This is going to allow our fab team to come across into Revit. So we had a bit of a, no, I'll not say a row, but a bit of a debate about whether it would work. And they gave me the go ahead then to try to do a trial for one of the jobs to do an energy center in Revit rather than the traditional way. So I took myself off down to prefab for, I think it was 2 months, and designed and did all the shop drawings for all the frames and pump rigs and all the hangers, because it was quite big pipework in that energy center. So all of the goalposts, PFC hangers and stuff were all developed purely within Revit, and all the shop drawings were produced directly from Revit and sent down to the guys on the shop floor without telling them that the system had changed, just to see would there be any impact. And there was none whatsoever. The guys didn't even notice that the software had changed. And it all went up to site and it all fit perfectly without being altered in any way at all. And that was kind of the light bulb moment for us to say, right, this is the way to go. So then that was another 6 months of training the three guys who work in prefab to use Revit rather than MEP. And they were really against it, to be quite honest. They were very used to working on MEP. And it really was a bit of an uphill battle with them guys to get them into the Revit sphere. But thankfully, they committed to it and they did it. And they're still there to this day working away.
Nice. Now, are you having to go back and kind of manage those catalogs?
No, I haven't, because it kind of, well, we've revised the FabCAD config file from that, because I realized that how I set it up really wasn't optimal. There was quite a lot of stuff in it that we didn't use. it slowed down the model quite a bit, and it made the auto routing make some crazy decisions, mixing and matching pipe segments and bend radiuses and stuff. So again, more recently there, I came up with a 2.0 version of our FabCAD config file, which is really streamlined for us. But the culmination of our prefabrication really came around in 2018 when we were offered a chance to look at the Claridge's Hotel in London, which I was talking to you guys about before. Sorry, just having a sip of beer there. Claridge's Hotel, just to paint a bit of a picture for the listeners, Claridge's Hotel is a hotel based in the centre of London in an area known as Mayfair, which is a very old part of London. It's a very, very expensive part of London, shall we say. The buildings are sort of built in around the 1800s. They're very old buildings. And this particular hotel, Claridge's, is one of the most prestigious hotels in all of Europe. It hosts royalty. So if anyone ever comes across from another country, like it hosts the presidents, it hosts all visiting royalty who would come and visit Her Majesty the Queen, the late Majesty the Queen there. Anyone, rock stars, film stars, you know, this is a very, very cool hotel. And what they had at that time was the hotel had kind of stagnated at that stage. You know, it had been on that site for 200 years. And whilst it was very expensive, it had fallen behind and surrounding hotels. You know, they didn't have a spa, they didn't have a pool. They wanted to add several floors to the top of the building for 7-star suites. But the problem was that all of the existing MEP plant of the hotel was on the roof. So when they initially looked at this project, it looked like they were going to have to close the hotel, and they reckoned it was going to take about 2 or 3 years to decommission all of the plant, remove it all, demolish the plant room, add the extra 3 floors that they were adding in, and then build a new MEP plant room on the new roof and reconnect all the services. They reckon that would be at least 2 to 3 years. And the hotel owners just point blank refused because they thought that it was going to totally affect business. A lot of the high class clientele wouldn't come back because of the disruption to their normal sequence of going to the hotel. So they started looking at the ideas. They contacted a few different consultancies here in the UK, and they spoke to Arup and McGee's, who were the main contractor who took on. And it was actually another guy from Northern Ireland who was the sort of the chief engineer, who said, well, let's dig underneath and let's dig under the hotel and create a basement substructure below the hotel while the hotel remains open and trading. And everyone was like, you know, that sounds ridiculous, but that's exactly what they did. They went down into the existing basement and they cut a 1 meter square hole out of the basement slab, which was a meter deep. In fact, it was about 1.5 meters. And when they started doing soil surveys underneath, they realized that it was London clay, and they surveyed all the site, and there was no London Underground. There was no major waterways. There was no major sewage underneath the hotel. So it looked like it was clear to go. So they actually brought a squad of Irish miners in from Donegal, and they actually started to dig underneath the hotel in the one corner, and they dug a network of tunnels to try and find underneath of the slab where all of the concrete columns were. And once they were basically, they only dug 2 meters deep, the height of a man. And they were putting these sort of steel goalposts in as they went every 300 millimeters to support the hotel as they tunneled underneath. And they did this massive network of tunnels underneath the hotel, and they were able to find all 64 columns of the hotel. And then what they did was they then started to mine vertically down underneath each column, and they put in a concrete case on, which allowed them then to dig all the way down. And the dug, I believe it was about 60 or 70 meters deep, and then created a new pile at 70 meters deep, and then created a standard concrete column all the way up, and then created a bulkhead column head underneath the existing slab, and put these hydraulic sort of bags in between the new head of the column and the underside of the slab. And once they had all 64 columns excavated and created, they then transferred the load of the hotel live to the new substructure. And they had Leica on board, who had monitoring stations on all of the surrounding buildings, pointing lasers at targets on the hotel. And they watched the hotel as they transferred the load to the new foundations. And I think the hotel dropped by about 15 millimeters overall. And this is while there were hundreds and hundreds of guests sitting in the tea room having their afternoon tea, blissfully unaware that this was happening, which is amazing.
Yeah, so I just want to reiterate to the listeners here, like this was a huge project. Imagine the president of the United States or the president of any other country, royalty from any other country, staying in this world-class hotel, fully staffed, fully occupied. And meanwhile, we're digging, you know, two brand new floors underneath this entire hotel. Like this is just absolutely mind boggle. Six extra stories under this hotel.
Wow.
that's insane. And everything had to work out perfectly, like you were saying. So like it had to have no waterways underneath, no random, you know, piping or sewer lines or anything. And it just happened to work out for this hotel that was able to be done, just because I think you were telling us before, instead of building up and adding on to the construction, if they did that, they'd have to close the hotel. So their alternative was to keep the hotel open and dig down, which is just absolutely mind-boggling. But it's awesome that, you know, between technology and Revit and everything was able to be precisely calculated as far as a game plan, and it was able to stay open and go extremely smoothly.
Yeah, well, that was a ARUP or a consultancy here in the UK, and they looked after all of the structural design, and they did all that obviously in Revit. And Mickey's were the main contractor who actually dug the basement out and constructed the basement. And it's hard to put into words, you know, to describe to anybody in a podcast. If anyone's interested, there's actually a documentary on the BBC. If you're in America, if you use a VPN, you'd be able to dial into the BBC and see it. There is an actual 3-part documentary all about the construction of the basement, and you can actually watch it and see it happening. They filmed the whole way through, so you can actually watch and see it happening and not just take my word for it, and get a much better explanation of it than I can offer on a soundbite. But once they had sort of established the columns, then it was all hand dug, by the way. There was no machinery used because of the noise. There was a stipulation in the contract that if any one of the high class people in the hotel complained, there was an automatic, I think it was £5,000 fine for every instance. Now the suite, the best suite in the hotel, cost £25,000 a night.
Wow.
Which is almost $40,000 a night. So that's the stakes that were at play with it. So it was all hand dug at the first outset. So all of the tunnels were hand dug, all of the what would you call them, the vertical shafts for all of the columns were all hand dug. And then once that was in place, then they actually brought in diggers, but they actually specially commissioned diggers that were hydraulic, and they rented a building up the street. And they put all of the generators and the machinery and the hydraulic machinery in that building and ran all the hoses down the street so that the stuff in the basement was quiet. It was amazing. Really was. So once the columns were in, then they started excavating around the columns. And as they went down, they cast each slab then as they went down. And they made a 6-floor substructure, which is amazing. So at that stage, they had finished the substructure, and that's when we were approached then to consider the M&E installation, because we were known at that stage. We were a good reputation in the industry for prefabrication and excellence in digital construction. We were approached then in around 2018 to consider it, and I'll never forget the first day I walked on the site and the shaft. They opened up the shaft, so if you can imagine, the original shaft they had cut in the basement slab was around about 1.5 meters square. They actually opened that up a bit more to about 3.5 meters squared. Call it 4 meters squared. So you're talking about 15 feet in US Imperial. And that was the whole access shaft for the entire basement. everything that went down, all of the soil that came out that hole, and everything that we installed had to go down that hole. So straight off the bat, everything that we designed had to be designed in such a way that it would fit down this hole. So straight away, the logistics in the site was a nightmare. It's in the centre of London. There was no site storage. There was no site access. If any of our walkers walked in the front door of the hotel, we were fined £5,000. So we had to always use the back doors to get in. So sequencing was a nightmare. Logistics was a nightmare. Site access in itself was a nightmare. So straight away, on my first day, I realised we're going to have to scan this thing and we're going to have to get a digital twin to work on, because we can't. Just the distance in itself, we're based in Northern Ireland, which is a plane. There's a sea in between us to the site, so it's not, you can't jump in a car and drive the site. You have to get on an airplane and fly an hour's flight to London and spend 2 hours in training to get into London to get there to look at it. So straight away I knew, look, you know, we're not going to be able to do this unless we completely take this offline. So at that stage, we had no experience in reality capture or any of that sort of stuff. And a good colleague and friend of mine, Matt Hull, actually works for Lega Geosystems Hexagon. And he sort of, I rang him and asked him, I said, Matt, you know, what do we do here? How are we going to do this? And he said, digital twin all the way. So we contacted a local company, Ridgeway Surveys, who actually were on site doing work anyway. And we commissioned them to produce a point cloud survey of the finished substructure basement. That took about 3 or 4 weeks to be done. And when that came in, then we had a point cloud of the constructed as built basement. The point cloud had 395 million points in it over the 6 floors, and it was about 25 gigabytes in size, if I remember rightly.
Nice.
Yeah. It was massive. So we didn't know how to use it. We were like, what do we do with this thing? You know, how do we use this? So we realized then we could actually create a as-built structural model from this. So we reached out to a few people in the industry that we knew that did scan the BIM services. And we waited a couple of weeks and we were provided with an as-built structural model that was millimeter accurate. All of the columns that were cast slightly leaning, the walls that were kind of kinked and the floor being uneven and the underside of the slab, you could see the texture of the concrete. It was phenomenal in the point cloud. And then when we looked at the Revit model that was provided, we were told it was within 1 millimeter, which was phenomenal. So we binned the original ARUP theoretical model and we superseded it with the as-built model. And that gave us the confidence then that whatever we were considering and designing in our Revit sessions, we knew that it would fit 100%. It was almost like a 3D photograph. You know, we didn't have to go to site, we didn't have to do site measurements. The confidence was there that this structure that we were working to was correct. Now, we did check it. Obviously, we measured a few places and had a couple of guys on site verify it, and it literally was within the millimeter, and it was phenomenal.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how were you guys doing the verification?
At that stage, it was manually done. You know, we were very much still in the dark with all this technology, so we were skeptical. We really were skeptical, to be honest. We thought, you know, surely there must be a bit of drift, or there must be a bit of tolerance, but it was surprisingly close. It really was.
Yeah.
I think the tolerance came from the tolerance could have came from a bend in the measuring tape. Do you know what I mean?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So we were delighted then that it was going to work. So straight away, we got stuck into it straight away. And we started looking at the conceptual design. So very early doors, it was LOD 100, simple blocks setting out where the boilers went, where the chillers went, where all the expansion vessels went. There was something like 15 pump rigs for the, because this was taking over the whole hotel. This wasn't just supplying the new part of the hotel. This plant room had to do all of the hotel. So we had to consider all of the existing systems and look at the existing risers at the back, and we scanned them too to see where all the existing pipework was at the very ground floor level. And that really gave us the whole picture to be able to start work directly in the model with good confidence that what we were producing was correct. And then sort of at that stage, virtual reality had sort of popped up on my radar as well. I am a VR gamer. I'm a bit of a nerd. and I'm an early adopter of VR. You know, I had one of the first Oculus Rift headsets that came out at the time, and obviously when you're on YouTube, and YouTube just basically shows me Revit videos and VR videos. So at that stage, I was shown all these softwares that were appearing that allowed you to look at a BIM model in VR, and it was revolutionary. I was like, wow, look at this. So while this was all sort of going on, and it was maybe just before Clara, just thinking about it, it was kind of at the same time, I reached out to Aris VR, or Prospect, is the app that we have sort of went with. And that was way back in 2017. It was kind of just launched at that time. So at that stage, I reached out to the guys. I think they were based in New York at the time. And I got a 3-month trial from them guys. And we started looking at our models in VR. But when we looked at the models in VR, we realized straight away, they're not good enough. You know, there's so much missing. We're not taken for fixtures, fittings, clips, hangers, the steels, you know. It became very apparent to me that if VR was going to work, it had to be one-to-one. It had to be a complete simulation of what we were intending to fabricate, or else it just didn't work. It really didn't work. So all these kind of things all appeared at the same time and came together. So it really, when we brought the fabrication services in, was it around about the same time I was looking at the VR. So it was almost like the planets aligned for me, and that I just had this eureka moment of VR is going to let me see exactly what we need to prefabricate, and fabrication services is going to give me the tools that we need. So the only thing that was missing was all of the fixtures and fittings and clips. And again, you go out to the manufacturers and they say, what's BIM? Sorry, what do you want? I don't know what you mean. So we were sort of stuck again, and what do we do? So I've always been into sort of modeling. You know, I did SolidWorks in university and component design. So I really started looking into parametric family creation then. So we started creating parametric families of all of our pipe clips, slide guides, all of the things that we knew that normally we didn't model, but we needed. You know, the boys would put it together. We would normally just float pipes down a frame. But we really needed to know, is that clip going to fit in that frame, and is our spacing correct? And so we spent about 6 months creating all of our custom families for pipe clips, slide guides, all of the stuff that you needed, but just wasn't available. And that kind of created the trilogy of requirements, and that was when one-to-one simulation kind of was born in Kane, and that what we model in our Revit is one-to-one simulation. Every screw, nut, washer, bolt, clip, hanger, uni-strut, threaded rod, everything. We have a parametric family for that allows us to ensure that our prefab layouts are exact. So when we try and say to our clients, you know, there's BIM 360 and there's our model, and they open it, they go, wow, that's what you're going to get. You know, that rig that we have designed is exactly what's going to be sitting on that floor to the millimeter accurate. We've made trough light stickers with the Kane logo and everything.
Mm-hmm.
That it's right down to the absolute everything.
And then have you built those families in Revit, or did you use fabrication for that? You built them in Revit.
We built them in Revit, directly in the family editor, just created half lap clips, you know, all the different types of clips that we would require, and all the slide mm-hmm. guides and everything. We just item by item created a parametric family. With shared parameters that allow us to schedule them. So that was the next thing that was born from that, off the back of it, but we didn't even realize. But another eureka moment, flip, we can actually schedule these now. So the fifth floor of the basement was the wet plant. So that was all the boilers and chillers and stuff. The floor directly above that was the air handling unit floor. So there was actually 27 air handler units went onto that floor to supply all of the fresh air and tempered air to the hotel. And a lot of these units had to be double stacked. And so you can imagine the amount of ductwork that was in that floor. It was immense. And some of that ductwork was 2 meters wide. So straight away, the hanging of those ducts and the goalpost brackets, as we would call them here, you know, the uni-strut and the two threaded rods, to hand that drawn to an engineer on site and say to them, off you go and figure out how you're going to put all these clips in and the sequence that you're going to put these clips in, because the ducts were like three layers deep at that stage. So we were able to go into the model. I created a custom parametric family that was basically a uni strut with two hanging rods and a phenolic block for insulated duct and a non-phenolic block for the normal duct that's not insulated. So we were able to go in and put all of the hangers in onto every single piece of ductwork, individually tag them all with a reference and schedule them on a table that told the guys on site the length of the uni strut and the individual length of both the left hand and right hand threaded rod that was required for the design. And we were able to elevate each one of them.
Did you guys use any automation for placing these views or putting your dimensions for kind of like your spooling? Did you use anything for automation or were you hand doing that?
At that stage, it was all hand done. We do automate now. I learned Dynamo. Then in the coming years after that, I found Dynamo and learned how to script automation. So that's a more recent thing that we've done. But at that stage, no, each individual hanger was manually placed, manually sort of adjusted to what was required. And all of the sort of naming and scheduling was all done manually. But even at that stage, the change from the guys on site trying to figure that out to being handed a drawn that it was all done and it was all scheduled. And we actually prefabricated all of the hangers at our head office and sent them in packs wrapped up with a tag on them. So the guys just opened the pack and there it was, everything they needed, like a Lego set. So nice. That was revolutionary at the time. The guys loved it. And it, the sort of final piece of the puzzle of all this, so we'd considered the building to a millimeter accuracy. We had considered our Revit modeling to the millimeter accuracy. So the last piece of the puzzle was, how do we set out all of these things to the same degree of accuracy in the real world on site? And that was kind of the last piece of the puzzle. So again, I reached out to my colleague Matt in Leica and I said to him, Matt, I have these massive frames coming to site that are full of pipes and I have four fixing points in them. How do I mark the underside of the slab exactly where I need that rod to be drilled? And he said, well, we have a system called ICON, which is primarily a tool for civil engineers and structural engineers that they use to pinpoint coordinate points and datum points for erecting steels and center of roads and right and left hand side of roads. Perhaps we could look at that and see, could we shoehorn it or adjust it to be used for what you guys need? And I was like, that sounds brilliant. So again, with all these things, there was a magic add-in for Revit that would allow me to place a coordinate point anywhere in the model that I would like to refer to a total station on site. So we were like, right, that sounds really good. So the first test that we did, again, we were very skeptical with this system. We were like, surely it couldn't be that. Surely it cannot be that accurate, you know. So what we did was, there was a requirement to drop a couple of cores from one of the floors to the other for soil stacks. So we put a coordinate on the top surface of the slab, and we put a coordinate on the underside of the slab. And our reasoning there was that you had to calibrate on both floors. So if the calibration wasn't right, it wouldn't line up. So let's see if it's right. So if I calibrate on level 4 and put a point on the floor, and then I walk downstairs to level 5 and I calibrate on level 5 and I put a point on the underside of the slab, what happens when we drop this core? So we did that and we drilled the pilot hole through the slab and it matched millimeter perfect.
Perfect.
And we were like, wow, amazing. Let's go. So we used that system initially to mark out all of the high level fixture points for the big frames that were holding all the lateral pipework. And these frames were massive. They were holding 10 inch pipes and they were probably 2.5 tons each in weight. So what that allowed us to do, because we marked the points out, we said, right, we'll do 3 frames and see what happens. So we marked out 3 of the frames in a row with the fixture positions. And that actually allowed the guys to go in, drill the holes, set the resin anchors and set the 20 mil steel rods down. We were able then actually to do a pull test, to do a load test on them and sign them off that there was no ambiguity. You know, this frame is going to stay there. It's not going to fall. It's not going to drop for health and safety reasons, obviously. And then it kind of worked in line with the logistics problem on the site, because there was no site storage. you know, we had to engineer this frame that had broken half and then could be hoisted and lowered down the six floors of the shaft and then get slid back together in two halves, moved over to position, and Genie lifted up in position. And when we did the first three frames, they were in, I think it was 30 minutes it took us to put three frames up.
Now, I gotta ask you, did you guys set up your overall coordination from the survey file, or how did you guys, because, like, I mean, when you go from a Revit model into real world, you know, when we talk about coordination of the model, and, you know, especially as you're talking about setting up those control points to help you calibrate, were you guys setting up to the survey? I'm assuming.
Yeah, well, we're fortunate enough that the guys who were doing the reality capture were the surveying company on site. They were there in both capacities. They were there as the survey company that were providing the control points, as well as doing any reality capture. So they had targets everywhere. So there was targets everywhere for us to use, and they provided all of the coordinates for us. We didn't really get into the coordinate part. We never really have. We always sort of, as much as we're advanced, we're not that advanced. We're happy to bring a surveying company in to give us the answers. But yeah, it was all based on real world geometric coordinates.
Well, that's huge. It's got to be, especially for that scale of a project. I mean, setting up off the survey has got to be, I mean, it's very, very important, right? Because as you said, if you're off a few millimeters, you're off an inch or so, that could be very detrimental to your project overall. So having that level of coordination for that many floors underground, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of did a schoolboy error. When the frames are out, the first three frames arrived on site, we realized that the fixture brackets on the frame had no tolerance built into them. It was just a central drilled hole of 20 mil. It wasn't a slot. So we didn't have any wiggle room left or right or forwards or back. And it actually didn't matter. It just went up exactly as is. And
nice.
It was almost like, did that actually happen? You know, there's no way that's real. So we were delighted, you know, it worked. And then we turned our attention then, right, let's look at the floor now, because we're bringing all these skids in and frames in. So let's put a coordinate point on each corner and we'll mark the floor as to where that rig has to go, so that rig sets exactly where we want it. And then that allowed us to prefabricate the connecting pipes between the rig and the lateral frame. So normally that would be a site measure and a site weld and a site grind, and guys would have to fabricate that in situ on site. That was taken out of it as well. We were able to, we gambled it. We said, right, well, the first five or six links, we'll prefabricate them based on the model and we'll send them. And if they fit, they fit. And if they don't, at least it's close enough that we can cut it and grind it and use a few Victaulic couplers to work it out. But again, all the link pieces come in and fit pretty much millimeter accurate. So at that stage, we realized that all of these technologies were required full time now. You know, there's no going back. There was no way we could go back to the original way of working. So then we looked at, right, you know, with this precision set and out system, how can we use this on our normal jobs, on our residential jobs? And at that stage, our residential jobs were really, really struggling with accuracy. And a lot of the residential schemes, we were being pulled back by the main contractor because lights and sprinkler heads were not aligned, because everyone was using different datums and maybe the datum wasn't built exactly right. So we were really struggling with rework and aborted work and ripping open ceilings and ripping walls open and things like that. So we took a few steps back and said, right, how can we use this coordinate satellite system to precisely locate all of our first fix items? So all of our high level ductwork runs, our hack bracketry, even the lights on the ceiling and all the ceiling based stuff, fire alarms, anything at all that we needed to sort of measure from a datum. We thought, right, well, let's take the datums out of it. Let's just give them their actual coordinate and we'll mark it on the slab before there's even a wall up. And we were fortunate enough, some of the tier one contractors we were working for at the time listened to us and actually agreed to let us trowel it on a floor. So the normal installation sequence was the props would go in, the upper floor would be cast, and then when the props come down, the dry liners are in, the wall guys are in, and they're putting all the frames in, they're boarding one side, And then when the MEP guys go in to start first fixing, it's a rat maze. You know, the guys are lifting toolboxes between rooms and they're running about, and it's quite a long process to first fix in that maze. So now what we do is, as soon as the props come down, we send our precision engineer, Daniel Lucas, on the site, and he goes on with his total station, and he sets out all of the points. And we came up with a color-coded system as well. So we've got a specific color for whatever the point is. So we use, for example, blue for the center line of duct runs, and every change of direction, there's a point, and that's the center point of the fitting. We use green for air terminals. We use orange for sprinkler heads. We use yellow for lights. So we walk into a floor plate, and on a typical building, there could be 1,000 points, and he can set those 1,000 points out in one day. One man, one day, 1,000 points, which is unheard of. And then the team go in the next day, and the MEP guys are in straight away, and they've got the full open floor plate to work on. And we can hang probably 70% to 80% of our services in an open space with the knowledge that it is exactly where it needs to be.
Yeah.
Because walls don't need to know where the walls are.
I think establishing that coordinate system, establishing that known coordinate system, like you said, right from the get-go, I mean, it's huge to helping everybody kind of, well, everybody coordinating and essentially know where everything's going, right? I mean, that's... It is huge. And when you have that confidence that you are millimeter accuracy, I mean, that's awesome. You know, you can really feel good about what you're doing and how your project is really going. Now, I think we've been at it for an hour here, guys. Gary, I want to thank you so much for coming on with us. I mean, I think honestly, if you'd be up for it, I'd love to have another podcast with you, and we can continue to kind of dive deeper into seeing how you guys are doing it. Now, the last piece that you were mentioning there, I do want to mention, like, that's very, very huge. Like, getting a color code scheme or getting a schema essentially for how you're going to, you know, kind of position yourself or a plan for how you're going to do either your layout measurements, your scanning. I mean, essentially knowing how you're going to, you know, position that in the project as you're moving forward, it's only going to help you downstream. But again, it's also how you plan to utilize the data, right? You got to have a plan for how you're going to utilize this level of data, because at the end of the day, you don't want to have this point cloud or these TopCon or not TopCon, excuse me. I keep thinking about the total stations. But whether you're using the total stations and you're taking measurements or you're using scanners, you know, and bringing that data together, aggregating that data, being able to position it and knowing that your coordination is right on. I mean, it's huge for your projects. And, you know, essentially, I mean, again, kind of going back to that, I know I said it a minute ago, but that confidence that really makes you feel good with that project and really at the end of the day also builds your trust with that software, with those workflows that you're using, like this stuff really works, you know, and even then, showing it to the field personnel, you know, the other team, it's huge.
Yeah, I mean, we've been doing this for a couple of years now. It's not like this is it's new for to talk about it to you guys and all, but we've been doing this now probably for 5 years now. You know, this is proven. And the benefit to everyone, because the change in sequence on site means that it benefits everyone on the site. It's not just us. Of course, we are the primary benefactors of this technology and this system. There's less people on site. There's less rework. There's less mistakes. There's less guessing. The stuff comes to site, it gets screwed to the underside. You know, we see a massive uplift in labor. We see a massive uplift in material wastage. We see a massive change in scheduling. You know, we were able to attack really aggressive programs now in the knowledge that we can hit a floor, whereas somebody else in the industry would say it's going to take us 8 weeks to first fix that floor. We'll do it in a week.
So your processes for the hotel were amazing as far as the layout side of stuff. I feel like you know, we've been doing it for a long time, but we've never called it BIM, or at least included it with the BIM terminology. It's always been, oh, that's the surveyor. And yeah, you might be doing layout and verification workflows with your robotic total station. I heard Dave do a shameless plug for TopCon there just a second ago with his little goof. But no, the
I'm leaving. BIM to me is a decade old word. I don't even use BIM now. I use virtual design and construction, VDC, because that's really what we're doing.
It's more apt terminology. I feel like the industry, or at least the manufacturers of technology, have latched on to terminology, and it almost annoys people in the industry. Like BIM, it seems like an old workflow, but it's still being sold. Like it's we sell BIM, or we do BIM, or whatever BIM. And
what part of BIM do you do?
Yeah, it's like, how vague is, like, when I hear people talk about digital twins, I'm like, okay, but what is your deliverable? What actually is part of the digital twin that we're talking about?
Because I have moved from the BIM side of just sitting in the office drawing drawings to literally interfacing directly with the op teams, and the technology that we're bringing in on the BIM team is directly affecting the site. So it's not just about the BIM model anymore. It's digital construction as a whole. You know, I consider myself, I don't call myself a BIM manager or a BIM guy. I call myself a digital construction specialist. You know, that's
there you go. I like that.
That's the future of it. That's where it's got to be. So, Gary, I appreciate your time today. I know it's late your time, and Dave and I've got to get back to our families here, but we do want to thank you for this episode, and we want to do a follow-up episode. We want to talk more about deformation monitoring, like you were doing with that building. You were talking about how you had the sights pointing at the building and actually, you know, able to see that the 15 millimeter move. I want to chat more about where you think the future of construction technology is, and at least not necessarily from a software standpoint, but thinking about where the roles, the people that are involved are going to be. But again, these are all topics for another time. I'd love to follow up again, and I appreciate your time today.
Yeah, no, I would be delighted to come and chat with you again, guys. I really would. And I've so really enjoyed today. Thank you very much for your invite today. I've really loved it.
Yeah, thank you, man. Honestly, time flies when you're geeking out, right?
It is indeed.
We've spent three hours before on these, and it's just like, oh my gosh, how easy it is to just lose track of time.
Oh yeah, I could talk about BIM till the cows come home. As I say before, you talk to some people about BIM, and if they're not in our industry, they just don't understand what you're saying. They don't appreciate what it is. You show them pictures and you show them videos, and they're blown away, but they just don't get
pretty
it,
picture.
You know. So
yeah,
it's lovely to be able to chat with like-minded guys. You know what I mean? And talk with guys who know what you're talking about.
Oh, 100%.
Gary, you've been an absolutely wealth of knowledge. I love listening to all your stories and seeing how you really came up with Revit. I look forward to having you back on, and thank you all for listening, watching, viewing, and subscribing.
Thank you, guys.
Take care.